Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a discussion titled, Are Americans God's Chosen People? Our speakers are both from Boston University, Professor of International Relations Andrew Bacevich and Professor of Religion Stephen Prothrow. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Dean of Students Ken Elmore.
First off, let me introduce to you Professor Andrew Bacevich, international relations professor here at the university, and certainly most folks will say an expert. He has recently written a book that I've had a chance to read, and it's called Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. On your right, my left, is Stephen Prothrow, professor of religion here at the university. God Is Not One is his latest book. So, Professors Bacevich, Professor Prothrow, I'm turning it over to you. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean Elmore. We had a little coin toss, and I was elected to start, so I'll say something quickly. I was reminded, as I was invited to do this event of a couple years ago, I went to find a book called The Irony of American History, which I had bought in college, written by the Protestant neo-Orthodox theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. And I don't remember now exactly why I needed the book 2 years ago, but I needed it sort of desperately, and I looked around my bookshelves in my office and my bookshelves at home, and I couldn't find it. I didn't know exactly what it looked like. I knew it had kind of checked blue and gray checked cover with boring letters, and I couldn't find it. And so I said, all right, I'm just going to order it online. So I ordered it online, and I got this book, The Irony of American History, and I opened it up, and I found out the introduction was written by Professor Bacevich, and I had followed his work, but I hadn't really read his work before. I had seen him on television and some radio programs. And I opened the introduction to this 1952 book on the irony of American history, and I read that, according to Professor Bacevich, this is the most important book ever written in U.S. foreign policy. And I thought, this is really strange, because it really isn't even a book about foreign policy, and it's not written by a statesman, it's written by a theologian. What a strange sort of claim. And then I read the introduction, the very first sentence, the times in which we live call for a Niebuhrian revival. So I thought I would start our conversation by asking if you could say something, Andrew, about Reinhold Niebuhr and explain why, in your view, he's relevant to our foreign policy conversations today.
Well, the book was written in the early days of the Cold War. Perhaps a moment not unlike the immediate post 9/11 period, in that it was informed by a great deal of conviction and certainty that international politics could be seen as a moral contest pitting good against evil, with the United States representing the forces of evil and therefore empowered to confer on itself vast prerogatives and to dodge serious moral questions about American power and its use. Niebuhr, to my mind, was an important voice of dissent that was heard at that moment, challenging Americans to question their first order assumptions. Not least among those assumptions had to do with who we are as a people, what we represent, and what our historical purposes are. And to cut to the chase, and I think this is what makes the book, lends the book its enduring relevance, is that Niebuhr emphasizes the role of our own sense of chosenness and singularity as providing the foundation or wellsprings, justification, impetus for what we do in the world. And it's in that sense, I think, that this book by a theologian just illuminates the foreign policy landscape and permits us to see that landscape in startlingly different ways.
So is one of the core ideas that when we do foreign policy, we're motivated not just by political, strategic, military questions, but also by theological questions? I mean, one word, you used the word certainty. You didn't use the word sin, which is the word that Niebuhr wants to use, which in the way he comes at this notion that we need to be humble, we need to be careful of hubris in our foreign policy activities is because human beings aren't God, because human beings don't know everything, because unintended consequences are always around the corner. Similarly, the notion of the chosen people idea, that somehow whatever we do may be sanctified, sanctioned by God, that we have a kind of messianic project as a nation to go out and maybe not convert everyone to Jesus, but at least convert everyone to democracy. There's a lot of theological baggage going on there. Do you think that our presidents and our State Department people who are making some of these decisions are motivated by a kind of unconscious theological project, or is theology just a kind of way to illuminate what's going on in terms of foreign policy, quite separate from religion?
I think that there have been times when the theological element has been quite explicit. I think that the immediate post 9/11 period. My own interpretation of President George W. Bush. It's very difficult to peer inside someone else's heart, but my own sense of George Bush as a man is that religiosity forms a very important part in making him who he is. That Bush, as a student of foreign policy the day before 9/11, someone who frankly hadn't thought a lot about it, but nonetheless viewed himself as kind of a soft, mushy realist who didn't believe in nation-building, as he said. That for President Bush, 9/11 served as a conversion experience in a very powerful way. And 24 hours later, he had come to emphatically believe in this American mission, which was articulated in secular terms. I mean, the mission was to export freedom and democracy, but which I think in his particular case really drew upon this sense of religious identity that was his. And I think that he is a striking example of that, but he's not the only example. I suspect that Woodrow Wilson, who in some respects Bush came to resemble, was also motivated by a deep sense of religiosity. That said, there are other moments in our history when the missionary impulse is articulated in ways that are more secular than they are religious. And one would cite, for example, the 1840s, the run-up to the Mexican War, which was articulated in terms of our supposed manifest destiny. If you go back and look at the writings of somebody like John L. O'Sullivan, who was a very influential journalist at the time, he doesn't talk about God, but he does talk about this providential purpose of the United States, which therefore not only justifies what was in fact a war of aggression against Mexico, but made that war both necessary and invested it with a higher and larger purpose.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like in terms of U.S. history, and in terms of this use of either religious or secular reasoning for our projects, right? Our expansion projects that you're so critical of in your work. It seems to me that starts, that goes back to Massachusetts. It goes back to the Puritan era. It goes back to the Sermon on the Arabella, where Governor Winthrop says, you know, we are a city on the hill, to which President Reagan in his ebullience and optimism adds the word shining, which I love. You know, we can't just be the city on the hill that everybody from Europe is looking to. We have to be shining. It sort of is going to blind them in some ways by our brilliance. But in that speech, he has at the end, he ends it with a sort of if then sort of thing, where it's very much open-ended about whether this project is going to succeed. It's very much open-ended about whether the covenant that we've entered into with God is going to lead God to bless us, or whether it's going to lead God to curse us, because it might well be that we don't pursue mercy and justice, and it might well be that we do pursue our own selfish ends and seek to become rich, which he warns us explicitly against doing. And so it seems to me on this chosen people kind of question that comes up with Manifest Destiny, and it comes up with Reagan, and I think it definitely comes up after 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that part of what we've lost is a sense that God may not just be on our side. You know, God may be mad at us for doing things that we should not be doing. I wonder whether that to you is a kind of sufficient chastening device, or whether we just need to get rid entirely of this chosen covenantal notion, and whether that notion is just irredeemable.
Well, we're never going to get rid of it, I think. I think it's one of these, this sense of singularity of American exceptionalism, I'm personally persuaded, is just hardwired into who we are. I think the challenge is to try to direct that sense of singularity in directions that the results can be positive. I think it's very important. It would be good for people to read Winthrop's sermon in its detail and to understand the context within which the phrase city on a hill appears. I agree completely with your reading that this covenant that Winthrop insisted had been forged between his little band of followers and God Almighty was a contingent arrangement. And the purposes for which his community had been summoned focused principally on fulfilling God's word. This is all spoken in a Christian context. And the sermon is laced with emphatic commands that, you know, we will conduct ourselves in ways that are consistent with the followings of Jesus Christ. We will love one another. We will turn away from the things of the world. We will live as brothers. And if we don't do that, he says, then we will be as a byword. We will be cursed. Cursed not only by God, but by subsequent generations whom we will have failed. I think one of the things that rather quickly vanishes from this sense of American exceptionalism is that it includes rather specific and demanding moral burden. Instead, American exceptionalism tends to become a device that confers prerogatives more than it imposes responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things that you see in the Winthrop sermon, and you also see in Reinhold Niebuhr, is this sense of uncertainty. You know, that we have a sense that we're in this situation with God, but God is God and humans are humans, and so we don't really know at any moment exactly what's going to happen, right?
Exactly right. You know, my sense is that apart from somebody like George W. Bush, American exceptionalism today tends to get expressed in more secular language. But if you went and took a look, for example, at President-elect Obama's Grant Park speech, the speech he gave on the night that he was elected. Incredible event. And one of the things that he said was, he reminded his listeners, all the American people, that we were called to bend the arc of history. And I thought, what an extraordinary claim. I mean, to say that you're called upon to bend the arc of history is to imply that history has a trajectory, it has a destination, that there's some intended place where history is going to end. Now, that does have, I think, a religious, implicit religious aspect to it. But simply as a citizen of the world, you know, casting your gaze back on the narrative of history just in the past 100 years, it's preposterous, I think, to claim that history has some predetermined end. And it's truly preposterous to claim that we can know what that end is, or that American power can somehow be mustered to bring history to this intended destination. But Americans believe that that's not preposterous. And that belief, I think, that history has a purpose, we can understand history's purpose, we are called upon to fulfill history's purpose, this is kind of a secular updating of the religiously informed version of American exceptionalism.
So he's conjuring Martin Luther King there, right? When King is saying, you know, the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice, right? So Obama is trying to conjure up King there and to say, okay, we can bend the arc of history. So I'm wondering.
See, that didn't occur to me.
No, no. Oh, go ahead.
No, I mean, it didn't occur to me, because my own sense of Dr. King, who I dare say you've studied much more closely than I have, is that he would be far more tentative in declaring history's purpose.
That's what I wanted to ask you, because I'm wondering, to go back to a conversation between Niebuhr, who, according to my friend David Chappelle, who wrote this wonderful book called Stone of Hope, he makes the argument that the key influence on King is Niebuhr, that Martin Luther King, when he was here studying at Boston University, he was totally immersed in the writings of Niebuhr. And I've never thought of King as a kind of hubristic person who knew where history was going. And yet I think certainly he believed, as a person of Christian faith and as a theologian, that the arc of history was bent toward justice. Mm-hmm. And he believed this with the Hebrew Bible prophets. Mm-hmm. And so I'm with him on that, but I'm also with you on saying, who are we to know the theological way is to say the purposes of God, but the historical way that Niebuhr puts it in Irony of American History is to know where history is going, right?
Isn't a distinction here, and I'm asking the question, I don't know, that when Dr. King says that the arc of history turns towards justice, Is his message not one to individuals, summoning them to live their lives in such a way that the cause of justice will be advanced, whereas the architects of American foreign policy, who claim to know where the arc of history, they're not calling on the people of Iran,
right,
to live their lives differently. They're basically cocking a gun so they can go tell the people, make
right.
the people of Iran live the way
right.
Americans
then,
think they
and
should
then
live.
When we engage in the Vietnam War, right, King is there to say, you know, and I wish I had the quote on, it was in the God in America TV series, if some of you saw, the great quote from King, where King says, basically, we need to be careful here in Vietnam because it may just be that God's going to come after us, right? I mean, it was very much like Winthrop, you know? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like Winthrop in the future. It was sort of like, don't you see now? We are, in this case, I think, the prophetic voice was, we're on the wrong side of history. But even that assumes we kind of know what side God is on in history, and we just happen to be on the other side, as opposed to, I think, the more Niebuhr position is, who are we to know, right? There's too much of a gap between God and us, or in the secular way to say, there's too much information flow for us to figure out, to be able to say, and then to jump forward, oh, we'll go into Iraq, and this will happen, and that will happen, and then A, B, C, D, and then all of a sudden, you know, this will be the case. I mean, I think that's where I may want to pull you into this conversation about Iraq and Afghanistan, that isn't part of the Niebuhrian position that you take up in both the your book on the limits of power and the Washington rules, that it's just hubristic of us to think we can have enough information, enough certainty to know, especially given how little we know about the religious and cultural facts on the ground in these countries, that we can enter into them and do anything that's really constructive. I mean, isn't that your position?
Sure, but it's also, I mean, I think a Niebuhrian sort of take on this is, yes, we must acknowledge the existence of evil in the world, that
right.
Somebody like Saddam Hussein is truly evil. And at the same time, that doesn't mean that we represent all that is good. That we must be aware of, attempt to be aware of our own faults, failings, limitations, and to some degree that perhaps could help you exercise a certain element of self-restraint and avoid going off and do stupid things. In Irony of American History, Niebuhr is quite explicit, for example, in condemning preventive war as morally unacceptable and stupid. Now, he's making this condemnation in the context of a prospective preventive nuclear attack
right.
against the Soviet Union, which of some people, not many, advocated early in the Cold War when we had a significant nuclear advantage. It's hard for me to read that condemnation of preventive war circa 1952 and not see its applicability to the war of preventive doctrine that President Bush articulated in 50 years later,
mm-hmm.
and what folly it was.
Yeah. To go to Bush, whom we mentioned before, after 9/11, he was incredibly outspoken on this question of Islam, right? That we are not going to war with Islam. We are going to war with evil. We're going to war with terror. Islam is a religion of peace. He said the sort of things now that he said the sort of things then that no Democrat running for office now would dare to say because they couldn't get elected. He sounds, when you go back and look at what he said, not even 10 years ago, like someone who you'd call a communist and a socialist for his crazy, you know, left-wing leanings when it comes to Islam. What do you think about the course of the Islam conversation? Islam is we're engaged in a clash of civilizations. Are we engaged in a clash of civilizations? And was Bush right to push us toward this more, I don't know, teddy bear kind of reading of Islam? Or is that itself a kind of naivete that we need to be warned against?
Well, I mean, on September 11, 2001, what did the average American know about Islam? What did I know about Islam? Next to nothing.
Right.
I mean, this, we would now, I think, all agree, represented a vast failure in our education, our understanding of the world and what's important in the world. I suspect where President Bush's effort to propagate the teddy bear image of Islam failed is that image was offered against the backdrop of our collective ignorance. I mean, we probably ought to, on September 12th, we probably ought to sort of called cease work across the entire country and adjourned everything and had a week-long seminar for every American citizen to learn what Islam is all about so we could then have an mm-hmm. intelligent political conversation. That education didn't happen, and therefore, over time, demagogues have the opportunity to advance a different perception of Islam, and we don't know enough to refute it. That
mm-hmm.
Some of us,
right.
to some degree, these outlandish characterizations find a certain amount of purchase mm-hmm. in certain quarters of our society.
Do you think it's different in the foreign policy apparatus in the United States in terms of what people who work in the State Department or even in the Department of Defense or even in the White House know about the religions of the world? I mean, one of the arguments that I've made in my last couple books is that to understand the world and to act in the world politically and militarily, we need to know something about Hinduism in India. We need to know something about Islam to deal with Indonesia. It seems to me our foreign policy has, at least in my recent memory, been working on the assumption that all we need is the tools of political science and economics. In other words, human beings are motivated by greed and power, and that's all we need to know. Would you agree with me that we need not just a week-long seminar for the country to talk about Islam, but we need more than a week-long seminar for our ambassadors, people in the Department of State, etc., if they want for our military, our counter-terrorists, our intelligence efforts overseas to be successful?
I'd emphatically agree, and yet I wonder even if we invested the necessary effort to provide that kind of education, if it would do any good. My sense is that in that world, in the world of statecraft, in the military world, there's a tendency always on the part of people in that world to want to harness the knowledge, to put it to work. One of my graduate students was reading a book, I think it was a week ago, about we were talking about U.S.-Saudi relations in the 1950s, and there was a serious proposal in the State Department that basically was advancing this notion. Well, the King of Saudi Arabia is the self-proclaimed protector of the Muslim holy places, so that gives him particular influence all across the Islamic world. We have influence with the King of Saudi Arabia, so if we can basically elevate his status so that he will be the equivalent of the Pope in Rome, then we will be able to influence, right. Have a means of influencing U.S.-Muslim relations. Well, I'm sorry, the King of Saudi Arabia is never going to be right. The equivalent of the Pope in Rome, but I cite that as an example, I think, of people, whether they know a lot about religion or a little bit about religion, given the business they're in, they're probably going to distort that knowledge or use that knowledge for purposes that don't necessarily make sense. Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a grim picture to me.
I'm in the pessimism business.
Yeah, I know. One thing that struck me about both of your last two books is that you go after these political figures, but you also kind of go after all the rest of us, too. You know, you go after the people in this room and myself for being, in a way, complicit with these Washington rules, as you call them, with the sort of assumptions about American exceptionalism, the uses of American power, and that we aren't doing our job to say no to our representatives, right? We're not doing our job to educate ourselves about what's going on.
Doing our job to say, well, what is the definition of freedom? What does it mean to live in freedom? What does it mean to be a free human being? Should it mean something more than walking around and, you know, paging through messages on your whatever it's called?
So what should we do then? What should we, ordinary people who are not, majors in international relations or professors of history and international relations, what is there for us to do? Part of what I push for people to do is to learn something about the world's religions so that they can engage in intelligent ways in this conversation about Islam in America or whatever, wherever else comes up. Who knows if Kashmir is the next big thing? We might need to know something about Hinduism, right? But what do you think? I mean, we have an election coming up. I'm not going to ask you who we should vote for governor or whatever else. But I mean, what can we do to address this problem, this kind of hubristic, aggressive American foreign policy that's sort of thrashing around with crazy schemes about Saudi Arabia and incredibly naive assumptions about what we can do in Iraq and Afghanistan? What can we do as ordinary American citizens and as college students? Join you in your pessimism.
My answer is... because I've been asked this question before. My answer is completely inadequate, but it's the one I believe to be true, and that is that we each should ask ourselves, we each should attempt to identify our vocation, because we are all different people with different talents and different temperaments, but we all have some, I believe, some purpose in life. And there is far too little time, I think, I suspect even in a great university, devoted to asking the question, where do I fit? I'm not an activist kind of person. I don't organize. I don't wish to have a public life in the sense of being in politics. That's not for me. But there are other people who I think are called upon to political activism, to running for office. Those people need to step up to the plate. There are other people who are called upon to live a private life, a decent life, to raise their family, to be a good neighbor, to make sure the garbage gets put out and the grass gets mowed. And if we had 310 of our fellow citizens who adhered to that vocation, we'd be in great shape. Mm-hmm. So I think it is a need to reflect in order to identify that calling, that place, and then to disregard the expectations of society at large or your parents or whatever, and go do that.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to open it up to questions pretty soon, but maybe can I say one more thing? One source of common ground, I think, in both of our writing, as I was thinking about this conversation, is a sort of distrust of simple schemes. So in my last book, I talk about how there's this common idea that the religions are basically the same, that they're different paths up the same mountain, and really, yeah, people pretend Islam is different from Christianity, but it's really not, and people pretend Sunni and Shia Muslims are different from one another, but they're really not, because it's really simple if you think about it, right? And I think in religion, there's a temptation for many people to do that. I think in politics and foreign affairs, the temptation may even be greater, because we want to imagine that there's simple solutions, right? Because otherwise, if there aren't, you know, we're in deep trouble, right? And I think this may take us back to Niebuhr, because a big part of Niebuhr, as I read him, is that that's the great seduction. You know, the simple scheme is, to use theological language, that's more likely to be the devil talking to you than God talking to you, because the world's complicated. Could you talk about simple and complicated and certainty and doubt when it comes to foreign affairs?
I think you're exactly right. I think President Bush's, this sounds like this is beat up President Bush night, but President Bush's freedom agenda, I think, would be an example of that. I mean, in one sense, it's based on propositions that I don't think any of us are willing to argue with, you know. Nobody wishes to live in a society in which the secret police can come knock on your door and throw you in jail. You know, nobody wishes to live in a society in which you're denied the right to worship or to speak. Of course, that's true. But to leap from there to the notion that freedom as manifested in the United States of America is somehow the authoritative version, and that the United States, with all of its power, should arrogate to itself the prerogative to deliver that freedom, really denies to the rest of the world the opportunity to proffer alternative versions mm-hmm. of freedom. Mm-hmm. That probably will to some degree overlap with ours, but won't necessarily be identical. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is this search for simple solutions. In our own day, the search for simple solutions has been compounded by a post-Cold War belief that superior American military power provides us with the ready-made instrument to implement those simple solutions. Mm. And that reflected a vast overestimation of that power and a vast misunderstanding of the nature of war.
I'm going to jump in right now. We're here with Professor Stephen Prothero, Professor of Religion, Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations here. They're having a great conversation, and we want to see if we can get more of us into the conversation. So if you have a question, and for the folks here, if you have a question, just raise your hand. Make sure you're speaking to the mic so we can hear you and catch you on the feed. For those of you who may be part of the online community, simply go ahead and text in or type in, and we'll make sure to try and get a few of you in as well. So I see we've got a question right here.
Yeah, you spoke about American values based on the Puritan value system. This country is actually made up of a multiplicity of value systems. There were the Quakers, there were the Scots-Irish, there were the planters, and then later the Catholics, Jews, Lutherans who came into the country. Given this multiplicity of value systems, you have to ask yourself, why is a particular value system chosen? Whose interest does it serve? I mean, it was very interesting for me to read in Last Call that the reason Prohibition was repealed was primarily because Pierre DuPont invested millions of dollars into repealing it because he thought he'd get his income tax lower. So I want to know is who's funding these value systems? I want to know who is funding these apocalyptic Christians who make up such a tiny portion even of the evangelical community and who are quite clearly lunatics. And who's behind it? I mean, is the military? Is it the military-industrial complex? Is it multinational corporations? Is it imperial interests? It boggles the mind.
I think the notion that Americans are God's chosen people, that this is an exceptional place, that we have a key role to play in history, that it's our job to spread democracy. I do think that that has roots in Calvinism, which spreads out into other religious ideologies, but I don't think that that's a lunatic fringe. I think that's mainstream America. I think it's really mainstream. And I think that it's a mistake to think of this kind of project that seeks to exert the power of the American military in service of improving and perfecting even the world, to see that as somehow evangelical and narrow. I think it's a rare American who doesn't believe this. This is one of the main points of your last two books, isn't it? That this isn't just crazy President Bush with his wacky, you know, conversations with Jesus. This is everyone, and it doesn't really require a DuPont or Bill Gates to fund it, because we all kind of grow up believing in this kind of special exceptionalism of America. So I wouldn't disagree, especially in this political climate, that there's a lot of money that is secret that we don't know where it's going. I think that that's a shame. But at the same time, I'm not sure that the ideas that I see at least fueling some of our American military adventures come from any sort of wacky place. I think they come from pretty mainstream American values that are shared now across a lot of different religious traditions.
We've got a question right here.
I just finished reading The Irony of American History in one of my classes. It was a great book. And one thing that we talked about in my class was that Niebuhr always stresses the middle ground. He explains both sides, American exceptionalism, American hegemony, and he talks about the irony of how, you know, we could believe in our own exceptionalism and use that as a justification to spread our hegemony, but then are we really exceptional if we're doing something like that? So pretty much his message was to stress the tension between two extremes. But it seems that in our history, people have interpreted his books to make very polarized foreign policy decisions. Why is that, and how can we stop that? Because in my view, and I guess in your view from reading your introduction, you think that his message is one of, you know, more caution and to make a more reasoned, pragmatic choice.
But you ask, why have people throughout history interpreted his views a particular way?
How can they interpret his views to make like, for example, very specifically, how can they use his book or his ideas to prefer isolationism or interventionism when what he's stressing is a middle ground between the two?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that's the way his book has been interpreted. I mean, one point to make is that the book had largely vanished until just a couple of years ago when this new paperback edition came out. Before the paperback edition came out, I was using the book every year. My students were paying like $40 a piece just to find one on the used book market. So the book, I think, had pretty much disappeared. My sense is that the political context in which the book was written was this. Niebuhr was a cold warrior. He supported the basic opposition of the United States to the Soviet Union as a necessary posture. The middle ground I think he was trying to take was the middle ground between a lunatic fringe that wanted to find an immediate end to the rivalry with the Soviet Union by starting a war on the one hand, and on the other hand, the isolationist remnant of the Republican Party that, from Niebuhr's point of view, would not have been sufficiently assertive. So in a sort of a narrow political context of an argument going on at that time, he's trying to chart a middle path.
Can I say something quick on this question about why he could be interpreted differently? And we may have a slight disagreement here. I think he has been, Niebuhr, interpreted wildly differently. There was a famous interview that pre-President Obama did with David Brooks, the New York Times, where Brooks asked him about Niebuhr, and all of a sudden Obama was just going on with these long, extended paragraphs about Niebuhr, this huge influence, Niebuhr. And it was almost as if when George Bush was asked, who's your favorite political philosopher, it was Jesus, and when Obama was asked, it was Niebuhr. But at the same time, Niebuhr was the favorite philosopher of the neocons who were all about crusading right out and going out. I think the reason for it already is Professor Basevich alluded to before. He says the cautionary piece is we can never know. There are always unintended consequences. We never know what our actions will bring forward in terms of their actual fruits in the world. There's a huge gap between our knowledge of the world situation and the way the world situation really is. All these are red kind of, you know, stoplights, right, toward action. Now, that may lead you to a kind of total isolationism. We can't do anything. But then he makes this move that Professor Basevich just referred to earlier, which is, but we must act, right? That's the key part. We have to be willing to sully ourselves. We can't be purists. We can't be sort of monastics who are going to make sure that we never do anything wrong or evil in a world that's filled with evil. So we need to act. We need to act, though, with the awareness that the things that we do may, in fact, dirty our hands. They may, in fact, backfire. So he has it both ways, too, right? I mean, he's not giving any clear, you know, message about stay away because too many unintended consequences and forge ahead, right? So it makes sense to me that people could read him both ways, depending on which part of a sentence or which paragraph in a chapter they're going to emphasize.
We've got a question right here.
Given the fact that history is a very past experience for us, and as you were talking about, we can never know what the implications of our actions are, it seems to me that it follows that we can never know what the implications of our inaction are. And is it the case that we should let the fact that we may be hypocrites, or that just because someone else is evil, we may also carry tinges of evil ourselves? It seems to me that to allow the fear of misaction to rule us is just as harmful. To be so afraid of changing history in a negative way to stop us from acting when it's necessary, despite our own shortcomings. And how might that affect our view of religion, particularly because many of them call for severe action in many situations, and many of them promote pacifism or provoke peace? It seems to me like there is a very large conflict there. And you discuss how religions are very complex. It's not just a simple divide or a simple unity between them. In what ways should we take into consideration the different callings that people may feel to act in light of just allowing evil to prevail.
You want to do that?
Well, we shouldn't allow evil to prevail. I mean, this again goes back, I think, to one of the core Niebuhrian message, but in some senses, a message is not tremendously helpful to a president who's sitting at his desk trying to make a decision about whether or not to go to war. Yes, we should be modest. Yes, we should appreciate the likelihood of unintended consequences. Yes, we should understand that the future is opaque. Yes, we should understand that evil is out there and to some degree needs to be dealt with. And on the other hand, we've got to do something. So all of that, I think, counsels in favor of modesty, of trying to do the best you can to anticipate the unintended consequences, knowing that you will always be wrong, to avoid being overextended. In other words, to maintain some power in reserve so that when these unintended consequences appear, you have perhaps some ability to cope with them. I don't think, and that may sound general and generic, I think it has a specific application. Again, to pick on President Bush, the invasion of Iraq was planned and executed with a very high level of expectation that existing U.S. military forces would be more than sufficient to accomplish the mission. And indeed, if you look at the March on Baghdad, you could say that events seem to vindicate that expectation. If you look at the events that occurred after the fall of Baghdad, clearly the Bush administration failed to have adequate U.S. military power to deal with the contingents that they had to deal with. And so we end up trying to make up the difference by hiring mercenaries with, again, all kinds of other negative consequences. Had President Bush really believed what he said, was that we were engaging in an open-ended, he didn't say open-ended, long-term global war on terror, if he wished to have war be the antidote to terror, I think it's a bad idea, but if he wished to do that, then he ought to have mobilized the country. He ought to have raised up a greater pool of military power to then be able to apply to Iraq or wherever else the case may be. I think Niebuhr would not have approved.
Professor Basevich, you ask, I read a recent New Republic piece that you did, and you pose a really interesting question in that as you look at belief and belief in this war, belief in certainly the war in Iraq, and also the way that President Bush looked at it versus the way President Obama did. I think you pose a really interesting question. Could you pose that a little bit for us?
Well,
because I think it's great to think about this.
This is people like me presuming to be able to read someone else's heart. But my sense is that when he made that decision, he did not wish to make that decision.
This is the decision to ramp up the escalation in
Afghanistan. When you look at that West Point speech, it's very interesting, the West Point where he announced the decision. In the West Point speech, on the one hand, he announces we're going to implement the McChrystal plan. Mm-hmm. And at the conclusion of the speech, he says, what we really need to be doing is rebuilding this country and rebuilding this economy. Mm-hmm. I think that was spoken from the heart. When you look at the Bob Woodward book that's been getting so much press, more press than other books get, written by other people, one of the very interesting things to come out of the Woodward book is that...
I've never heard of that book, by the
right,
way.
That the president, in the run-up to that Afghanistan decision, the president demanded to be presented with real options. He wanted to be the person to make the basic decision on how to go forward in Afghanistan. And the people in the Pentagon, who were working up whatever the decision paper was, gave him three variants of a single option. Mr. President, we need a big decision today. Would you like to send 10,000 more troops to Afghanistan or 20,000 or 30,000? And according to Woodward, the president responded to this by saying, you're only giving me one option. choice is being taken from me and exercised by somebody else who knows what they want to do in Afghanistan. He knew he was being gamed, and he let him get away with it. I think that's deeply troubling from any number of perspectives, not least of which is what it tells us about the way the principle of civilian control actually works. And the answer is not well.
Doesn't this also fit into your point that you've also made, that presidential power in a way is overrated, right? That there's a way in which they're a figurehead for all these things that are happening around them that it's very difficult for them to resist, right? I mean, Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial sure. complex, but you talk about the Washington rules, that this is just sort of the way it works. And it's very hard for even someone, I mean, if Obama can't do it, right, the change agent,
but this also comes back. This also comes back to the question of our own culpability. We have bought into the notion of a messianic president. I mean, the enormous enthusiasm that accompanied the 2008 election, I would argue, centered on the expectation that if we can just get this man in office, then everything will be changed. That was an illusion, and I think events have demonstrated that that is an illusion. So simply finding the right person and installing that person in the Oval Office is not going to fix things.
We're going to have to make that the last word. Thank you very much. Give them a round of applause. Professor Andrew Bacevich, Professor Stephen Cockrell.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a discussion titled, Are Americans God's Chosen People? Featuring Boston University professors Andrew Bacevich and Stephen Prothro. Tonight's moderator was Ken Elmore, Dean of Students at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Mark Liambruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lightodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.